Bangladesh goes to the polls on 12th of February, 18 months after the overthrow of the long-term leader Sheikh Hasina. Her Awami League government was brought to an abrupt end when a popular uprising toppled the long-term leader. For the last 18 months, an interim government led by Nobel laureate Mohammad Yunus navigated the country, and now elections will see a permanent government try to navigate the South Asian nation through its countless challenges. Here to navigate us through all of this is Ghazi Ahmed, who is based in Bangladesh and is Geopolity's South Asia analyst, and also, as ever present, the Geopolity founder of Adnan Khan. Hope you guys are well.
Yeah, I'm good, Imran and Ghazi. Good to see you both again.
Ghazi, yeah, good to see you. Good to see you. I'm fine.
Yeah. I want to remind all our listeners that you can find us on all the major social media platforms where you can subscribe and never miss anything. It seems like a long time ago when Sheikh Hasina was overthrown. What has been going on since then? So Ghazi, I want to start off with yourself. Specifically, what's been happening in Bangladesh since the removal of Hasina?
Okay. After ousting of previous Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina, who is the leader of the Awami League, after his 17 years of rule, people saw a authoritarian regime, more authoritarian day by day, and oppressing, and there so much pro-Indian instance that make the Bangladesh people is unhappy, and economic situation is going down for the last 2 years, where she is championing the GDP growth for last 15 years, something like that. So after that, on 5th August, her downfall ultimately came after 15 years. And on that day, I was also on the ground and visiting her ransacked residence. At that time, I remembered that suddenly one of the revolutionary leader, he's just posting in his Facebook post, a new post that in Yunus we trust. So actually, like me, the people in Bangladesh, in the street, they are quite perplexed. Suddenly, the Yunus name is floating out. So after that, people are confused. What are going to happen? But with Yunus coming to Bangladesh and his signature speech and the speech of hope, people, especially in the youth, they are keeping confidence on him that he can do what they want.
So, Adnan, what have you been seeing for the last 18 months from Bangladesh?
So probably four clear things, Imran. Obviously, an interim government came in pretty quickly. The famous Nobel laureate Yunus, Mohammad Yunus, he was elected. And what these interim authorities have tried to do is pursue broad reforms. And that's even included a constitutional charter. Because obviously what happened with the Awami League government was it became quite authoritarian. A lot of power was really within their grasp, which didn't allow the opposition. One of the things that they come up with, the interim government, is a roadmap. And this is for political reforms, which is going to lay out the steps that they were going to take. And, you know, the execution of this hasn't been great. It's been slow. Although most of the parties signed up to this roadmap, it's included even constitutional changes, which is becoming a bit controversial, which I'm sure we're going to discuss. It's probably going to be a bit of a problem actually afterwards, after the election, that is. And then the fourth thing we've seen really is legal action against the former regime. Obviously, Sheikh Hasina has been given the death sentence in absentia. A number of senior members are going to be on trial, and obviously a number of their members have gone into hiding. So 18 months in many ways is not a long time, but it is a long time in politics. So not too much has happened. Really, what people wanted to see was a free and fair election. So that's why certain things had to be put into place, and that's where we are now. I'm sure we're going to discuss how much is potentially going to change after the election.
National elections in Bangladesh are scheduled for the 12th of February. Can you give a breakdown of the of all the parties that are taking part?
So there's probably three main parties. You've obviously got the BNP, who are likely or even looking as though they're going to win. Their leader, Tariq Rahman, who was with us here in the UK for the last 15 years, he's gone back. He returned after a long exile. I think it remains to be seen. It'd be interesting what Ghazi thinks. Will they win an outright majority or not? If they don't, then this is where Jamaat Islami comes in, who's likely going to form some sort of alliance with them. They were once banned. Now they're re-entering politics. They're going to be contesting the election after moderating a lot of their strategy. So if you haven't seen the leader of Jamaat Islami, he was interviewed by Al Jazeera and he was laying out how he viewed things. You've also got the National Citizenship Party. Now, this is formed by a lot of the leaders from the student movement that helped topple Sheikh Hasina. They're trying to position themselves as a fresh force. I think with this particular election, the expectation is quite high. There's going to be a lot of Gen Z voters and who were quite central to the uprising back in 2024. But a lot of these youngsters are actually expressing a lot of frustration because they're saying we're not really seeing a proper political alternative. What we're seeing is the same old parties, the same old individuals again. So these are probably the main parties really to look out for.
Ghazi, living in Bangladesh, who are the people of Bangladesh inclined to vote?
It comes actually in the result of the revolution. So why people do the revolution? Here is the answer, I think. So actually, people do the revolution for the three points. For last 15 years, they saw an authoritarian regime that keep oppressing them. Economy is not doing well, and Indian hegemony is very much rising, that people feel insulted as a nation, as a Bangladeshi, they feel insulted. So after revolution, so there's demand is the reforms of the state institution that previous regime is using to oppress them, and a equity-based relation with India. So they're not oppressing or hegemonic role. They're not playing the hegemonic role on the Malaysian people. They want to be independent, and their relation should be equity-based. And third thing is economy should be doing well. It should be stable. And they keep offering jobs for the new graduates, for the youths. So this is the what people actually want.
Adnan, one of the key demands after the overthrow of Sheikh Hasina was the constitutional changes. What can we expect after the elections on the February 12th?
So last year in July, the interim government, they came up with the July Charter, which was a series of reforms that the people want and was probably the main job of this interim government. And there's two issues there. Firstly, the reforms don't seem to go far enough. And actually, their adoption has actually been pretty slow. So the BNP signed up for this charter. And really what this charter is it's trying to strengthen legislative oversight. It's trying to balance executive power. It's trying to enhance accountability and really create transparency amongst government institutions. And obviously, all of this is the opposite to what's going on for the last 15 years. So these reforms are really to ensure what happened under the Awami League government, that doesn't really happen again. The charter is going to require a constitutional amendment, which is going to require two-thirds majority, which is going to be a bit of a struggle itself. So to get these reforms passed, you're going to have to get the agreement of all of the members of the parliament and the different factions. And each of them, their interests may actually be quite different. So fundamentally, you're not seeing real change here. What you're seeing is a bit of tinkering with the system. Let's change this, let's change that, let's tinker with this. You're not seeing the complete uprooting of institution and system and a completely different one. And this is what the people protested about, that they were unhappy with the government, but they were unhappy with the economy, the structure of the nation and the political system. So the reforms don't appear to be going far enough. So we'll have to wait and see what actually happens. It's very likely, I think, once the elections are done, I think it's going to be a struggle. You're going to have to get a lot of agreement on these. I think some of them will be straightforward in terms of dealing with the Awami League Party, dealing with some of the members. But fundamentally, you've got a system at the moment where if you're in power, you've got significant power. Do you really want to dilute that by sharing power with other institutions? Now, the people want that because of what happened over the last 15 years. But once the BNP is in power, they may actually not want that. So again, it's something we're going to have to wait and see.
What are the chances of a second revolution happening? You know, one's happened already. If this charter is not executed successfully, what are the chances of people coming out back on the streets?
So it's possible, but I think a lot has to happen for that to happen. Look, we've just seen uprising in Iran. You've seen the Gen Z uprisings across the world. And then if you go further back, you had the Arab Spring. You know, these were countries where effectively the economy stopped working for the people. You had brutal leaders. As bad as Bangladesh is, a lot of these factors aren't there. So I think if they don't deliver, people will probably resort to demonstrations and things like that. So in the long run, it's a possibility. I don't think it's a possibility in the near term. I think in the near term, the parties and people will probably resort to other actions. So unless the BNP win and over time they turn into another Awami League, become authoritarian, iron grip, then that's likely. But I don't foresee that for the moment in the short term. In the long term, this is possible.
Moving on to the economic situation, you know, it's primarily the reason why so many came to the streets. What can we expect on this front after the elections? So Ghazi, specifically for yourself, someone living in Bangladesh, on the ground, how difficult is it for, you know, the normal individual? Forget your businessman, you know, the one who's working hard. How difficult is the economic situation for this individual and this and their families?
Okay. For the individuals, every individuals in Bangladesh, the main problem is high inflation. So economic situation is so that it's quite from the outside, it's quite seems like it's okay, everything is fine, but people's every monthly income is strained by the inflation that left by the previous regime. And this interim regime also failed to improve the situation. It's a quite. It was like 12% in the previous regime, and now it's something like around 9%. So it's not quite good here. So for individual Bengali, for the their monthly income is strained by the inflations. And no new investment. So this is the effect on them. So no new job creation. And on the other hand, Bangladesh's premier export earning sector, the RMG sector, has seen some unrest in the industry because of some big groups of the RMG sector is from the previous regimes, owned by the previous regimes members. So government's corruption drive against them left the industry, those factories closed. So almost 1 lakh, around 1 lakh garments worker left out from the job suddenly. So garments is actually a backbone of Malaysian low-income people, so there is a big impact for them too. So this is for the normal Bangladeshi, this is the economic situation is here.
Adnan, your thoughts on the economic situation post elections?
Yes, the economics is really going to be the main challenge for the new government. Even the transitional government, it tried to grapple with the economy amid the political uncertainty and they didn't really succeed. So there's probably a couple of issues really they're going to have to prioritise. First is energy. A number of contracts were signed under the previous government and these remain very costly and very controversial. Bangladesh doesn't really, I mean, it imports most of its gas. It has to import nearly all of its oil. They're going to have to look at this, potentially their own resources or further out in the Bay of Bengal if they can develop infrastructure there. The other issue, and probably the main one, is Bangladesh has a major structural reliance on ready-made garments. I mean, it's about 80% of exports, but it's about 10% of the GDP. But if you start taking into account all the other related industries, that's actually a lot more higher. And this is a very narrow industry. If you're not involved in this, you're going to struggle. If you're involved in it, you've got to go to the supply chain. So really, the government's going to have to focus on diversifying the economy. So they need to develop agriculture. They need to develop ICT services, so information, communication, technology, renewable energy. Bangladesh is on the Bay of Bengal, so they need to be looking at manufacturing and logistics. All of this requires long-term investment, long-term thinking. Otherwise, you know, this country, 170 million people, and you just got one main industry, it's very lopsided. Then the other problem is under the Hasina government, Bangladesh turned to the IMF, and the IMF has a long history of messing countries up. I think the BNP are going to likely have to agree to IMF terms because they're going to need to get dollar reserves, which is coming from the IMF. But the IMF, you look at Egypt, you look at Pakistan, you look across the Muslim world and beyond, they have a track record of messing economies up. They want reforms, and those reforms usually are you open up your economy. And this is why we are where we are with Bangladesh. Bangladesh opened up its economy to the world, and really, all they've been doing is ready-made garments. Well, that's dominated the economy. Now, to move away from that, you've got to diversify, and that requires long-term investment. So yeah, these are really going to be the major challenges.
Whoever does come in, whether it's BNP, Jamaat Islami, any other party, as far as I know and what I've read, they are going to be accepting all the IMF loans.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it would do your political prospects very good if you ran a campaign on no to the IMF. Although they may say that privately. But with Bangladesh, you know, I mean, there are options, which I'm sure we're going to talk about in terms of China. But yeah, I mean, if you look how many countries have taken IMF loans, especially across the Muslim world, and then when the government's changed, they've done a U-turn on that. No one ever has. So yeah, I think it's very unlikely. I think with Bangladesh, is in some ways, it's similar to Syria. People are just happy the former regime's gone. We've got a blank sheet of paper now. We're starting new, and there's hope. However, the challenges the government has got to deal with is the same challenges the previous government had to deal with. So those problems haven't gone away. They're still there. And that's what people really got to be measuring the regime, whoever it is. They're really got to be measuring the government on how they plan to deal with these rather than based on personalities.
Yeah. And it's not just the Muslim world, you know, who has suffered from IMF loans. It's the entire world, whether it's the African countries or, you know, South America, everyone suffers. Ghazi, this is a question for yourself. You know, they leave a massive hole in the political system. What can we expect, you know, going forward? Are Awami League, they are banned, essentially, but are they going to be quiet about it? Are people going to be, you know, coming from Awami League and staying stum about it? Or are they going to be defecting? What are your thoughts on Awami League?
For the Awami League, I would say they're in current aspect, they are actually irrelevant. So they are not coming back, I think, for the new future. So they have also a big supporter base in Bangladesh. Still, there is. So two alliance for both BNP and Jamaat led alliance, they're you see that they're in public demonstration. They're trying to draw those votes from Awami League by telling them the confidence word. Okay, so they're telling them that we give it security and something like that. So they're actually it looks like Awami League voters are now became a swing voter. So they will defect to those or vote for those who give them confidence, their security, of the security. So this is all happening. And recently, there are several news for last few days that Awami League leaders, some grassroots leaders are defecting to other parties, joining other parties with their all supporter base. So this is all happening. It's happening previously also. It's during election, it's quite common here. So for the Awami League, I think there's no, in current perspective, there's no coming back for them.
I mean, that's one way, one manner to save yourself, isn't it? Because, you know, all of the parties who are standing for election, they have said that they will be holding Awami League supporters and, you know, previous leaders to account. So that's one way of saving your skin, essentially. Adnan, who can, and this is being realistic, who can replace Awami League? You know, Jamaat-e-Islami seems to be making a lot of noise. I did watch that Al Jazeera interview with the leader of Jamaat-e-Islami. You know, a car crash is the word that comes to my mind of that interview. But again, being realistic, who can replace Awami League?
So it's difficult. I mean, if you look across the Muslim world, I mean, especially South Asia, if you look at India, you look at Sri Lanka, you look at Pakistan and Bangladesh, you've really got what two main parties, feudal parties, have dominated the political landscape, dynastic families, and then you've got the army. That's really been the setup for a long time, and that's probably half of the problem. And you get this merry-go-round where the two parties just take turns, really, to loot the country. I mean, interestingly here, the student protest movement, they've set up their own party now. And, you know, they're really targeting the youth vote. And across South Asia, a large chunk of the electorate and a large chunk of the population is younger. So they've got the potential for the future, but they're going to obviously have to reach out to different factions in their societies, try and win them over. And again, it's a new party. It will take time. I mean, the Awami League obviously has its origins in the founding of Bangladesh. The BNP, obviously the founder was the army general who became, or the army colonel who became the leader, and he set up a party to make sure his family would remain. So we'll have to wait and see how it comes. But at the moment, I mean, effectively the Awami League's been banned, its leader's been handed a death sentence. The BNP have said that they will pursue legal action against senior Awami League leaders. So they plan to do investigations, do arrests and do trials, you know, target, you know, what happened in terms of corruption, mismanagement, abuse of power. So I think, yeah, the Awami League's, they're going to be out of action for quite a while, which does leave space, actually, for another party to emerge. The thing with South Asia and across, especially the Muslim world, look, parties can come and go. You know, a lot of them don't really have longevity. And that's because a lot of the parties are based around a personality. They're based around someone who's a bit popular. And the problem with that is that the whole party's development and evolution depends upon this person's personality. And when he goes, it completely falls apart. So if you look at the Awami League, without Sheikh Hasina, you know, what really is it? Take the BNP, without Tariq Rahman, or his mother's gone now, but anyone from that family, it's going to be a struggle. So definitely there's space now for someone to emerge. And interestingly, the students set up their own party. They didn't completely invest in Jamaat-e-Islami or the BNP. So yeah, definitely something we'll be watching.
If, for example, Jamaat-e-Islami comes into power and, you know, on paper, it's a Islamist party. And, you know, whatever you read, people asking the same question, are these individuals, are they going to be ruling by Sharia? If they were to, hypothetically speaking, if they were to come into power, Ghazi, what does it show for, you know, about the people of Bangladesh voting in a so-called Islamist party like Jamaat-e-Islami?
Oh, okay. You are correct that Jamaat-e-Islami, as it is presenting Islam from the very beginning, that their Islamist party, they want to apply the Sharia after coming to power, and some sort of Islamic laws they want to apply. But this time we see a quite a different approach from them. So they are reaching out to people and reaching out to civil society and the secular bloc and also the foreign powers, that they are not actually established the Islamic Sharia. So they are actually said that in other hand, they said that they're pro-Islam and they'll apply some sort of Islamic laws. And on the other hand, when asking from the civil society and in several demonstration and in and the talk shows, their leader said that no, we're not applying Sharia. Women can freely move or whatever they wear. They can do jobs, all things, anywhere. And they are not, they actually give the narrative to the people that this Islamic law doesn't mean that rigid things.
Yeah.
So they're in different approach. So recently, even the Washington Post gave a, I think some they have met some women journalists in Dhaka embassy. So they also express something like that, that the Jamaat assured them that, that these things will not happen. And they will definitely give 100% tariff on Bangladesh if they apply the Sharia law. So it's they have some understanding with the United States in backdoor. So this is what Jamaat actually presenting this time. When they go to people, they change the narrative. They say, yes, this is the Islamic law will apply, but this not the way you think that this way. The, this is the one thing. So it's quite complex. I don't know. I feel that in the street in Bangladesh, that people in Bangladesh, they're actually very loyal and to their belief, the Islamic belief, as a majority people of the are Muslim. So they actually don't want a distorted Islam or a narrative that is not go with the Islam. They instead of that, they will vote a secular. This is the current environment in Bangladesh. Actually, people think like that.
Jamaat is essentially telling the people what they want to hear, very pragmatic approach, and be interesting to see what happens on the 12th. Adnan, your thoughts on Jamaat Islami?
You see, the problem with the Jamaat Islam in Bangladesh, and it's got the same problem with the Jamaat Islam in Pakistan. They're an Islamic group, but their politics isn't Islamic. Their politics is pragmatic. Their politics is one, let's join coalition governments. In the end, they end up giving a leg up to whoever's in government. We've seen that in Pakistan, and we've seen that in Bangladesh. Jamaat Islam has always been linked to the BNP. They've always been like the junior partner. And in the end, they end up giving a leg up to whoever is the ruler around the country. I mean, we keep going back to the car crash interview with Al Jazeera, but I mean, he put his cards on the table. You know, we're going to leave it. Every specific question he was asked, the Jamaat Islami Amir, he was like, we're going to leave it to the people. We're going to let parliament decide. We're going to let democracy decide. And then when he asked him specifically about female rulers, about some of their policies, then he would resort to, we leave it to the people. And this has really been the problem with Jamaat Islami in the subcontinent, where the group may be Islamic in terms of its orientation. Their politics hasn't been, it never had been. They've been junior partners. And even when they've been junior partners, they've moderated their image. And in fact, that car crash interview with Al Jazeera really was an attempt by them, I think, to just show that, look, we've moderated our message. Look, we can be responsible partners in parliament. You can rely on us. Meaning we're not going to change too much. Yeah, you know, we've got some demands. It may be Friday should be a national holiday for Jummah. You know, Eid should be a national holiday, but don't expect more from us. Really, on the key things that I'm not talking about it, or we're leaving that to whoever's going to be in government, Fatah Rahman and these sort of guys. And that's unfortunately been Jamaat Islami in the subcontinent, really, for the last few decades.
Yeah, essentially, they don't want to rock the boat because they know what's coming next, isn't it? I want to move on to foreign relations, and specifically India. India has been the biggest loser despite taking in Sheikh Hasina. Where do current relations stand between Bangladesh and India, and what can we expect post-elections? Adnan, your thoughts?
Yeah, so you're right. India was the biggest loser. I mean, they seemed they were a bit surprised with what happened with the uprising. And because they had completely invested in the Awami League, I mean, there's a security relationship between the Awami League and India that goes back to the, well, to the origins of Bangladesh. So as a result, there's always been a close relationship. So it's a bit like if the Awami League fell, they've lost everything. Interestingly, this seems to be a common pattern with India. India invested in the Northern Alliance government in Afghanistan. And when it fell, they lost everything. So now they're having to talk to the Taliban now. They've lost everything. So they were quite unhappy, obviously, what's happened. Their media went completely into overdrive, saying this is a proper Islamist plot. You know, it turned into a Bollywood film in the end, what they were doing. It was so silly. Look, there's a geographic
reality. When it comes to Indian politics, is somehow linked to Bollywood, isn't it?
Yeah. There's a geography challenge here, yeah? Bangladesh is surrounded by India, apart from the south east, where it has a border with Burma, Myanmar, really is surrounded by India. So whoever's in government, you're going to have a relationship with India. The problem really we see from India is historically, you know, even when Bangladesh came about, there was a opinion in India that this should really be a province. So Bengal should be a province within India. So some of them were really unhappy that we helped them liberate themselves from Pakistan, West Pakistan. But why are they separate? So you've had this. So the best they come up with is that, look, we have such a close relationship. It's as good as being a province of India. So yeah, it's autonomous, it has its own government, but they're loyal to us. So obviously that's all gone now. So that's why they're going to have to do what they did in Afghanistan. You're going to have to take it on the chin and start developing relations, because Bangladesh, you share a border with her. You've got no choice. And their biggest worry, which I'm sure we're going to talk about, is China. If the BNP government now continues with relations with China and expands them, that's a big problem for India. So I think India, Delhi is probably more worried than they will be in Dhaka. In many ways, the government is in the advantageous position. It's, you need us. If we're not on your side, you've got a problem. So really, they can actually dictate and demand. And let's see if they do that, because unfortunately, a lot of the leaders in the Muslim world have a tendency, even in the position of strength, they'll work from a weak hand. But definitely, India is worried, and they are sitting there watching. I mean, just don't follow what the media say. And let's hope in Delhi they don't follow what the media say, because that would be a complete disaster.
Ghazi, what's the public opinion on India and Modi and BJP and so on and so forth from, you know, on the ground, from the people of Bangladesh?
Okay, for the Bangladesh people, the Dulai uprising is one of the main factor was Indian exploitative nature, which is investing on Awami League. So India is exploited. This nation is so hard that it's left a scar on the mind of the youth, especially the youth of this country. So I want to say one last sentence about this: that whoever will be the will be from the government next time, they will keep in mind that India is not a not. They will not have a exploitative nature or the relation they had with the Awami League government. So government, the new government will think about this, and this public sentiment against India will force them to recalibrate their relations with India. So India, the last 15 years was the heaven for India in Bangladesh. It will not going to happen in near future, I think.
The average person, especially with what happened with the cricket situation a few weeks ago, the child of Bangladesh, do they hate the Indians and everything that they stand for?
Yes. Last time in the Indian Premier League, there was lots of Bangladeshi from the national team played there for the last few years. So this time, amid the disinformation and misinformation campaign from the Indian media and the Indian government, supported by Indian government and their Hindu nationalist parties, so it's enticed this decision to remove one of the player from the Bangladesh from the IPL. So Bangladesh government take it seriously, as there is an anti-Indian sentiment is here very high. So with the backing of the people here, Bangladesh Cricket Board, I think this is an unprecedented move from their side. Yep. So that they take a decision. If you want us to play this World Cup, then you should move the venue to the Sri Lanka, not in India. We'll not play here. So as ICC dominated by, as we all know, the ICC is historically dominated by Indians. So they don't give in. So as a result, Bangladesh is not playing this time. And people also welcome this. People in Bangladesh are very, very crazy about the cricket. But it's very well that they welcome this. They didn't protest. Why you were not playing? They welcome it. This is the history of Bangladesh.
Talking about cricket, I want to move on to Pakistan. Pakistan's eyeing up a defense pact with Bangladesh. We saw many individuals at the time of the revolution calling for essentially brothers to come together between Bangladesh and Pakistan. Adnan, are the relations now warming towards both nations? Because unfortunately, the historical aspect of the 1971 war is still rife. How are things going to be panning out between Bangladesh and Pakistan?
Yeah, so historically, as you mentioned, relations have been quite tense or non-existent, really. Interestingly, the BNP has always wanted a working relationship with Pakistan. The Awami League, obviously, they were completely pro-India. You know, as far as they were concerned, Pakistan was the enemy. And you find even when there were talks between Pakistan and Awami League Bangladesh, it always started from, here's our list of things that you have to apologize for, you have to accept a genocide, and you've got to pay compensation. The interim government actually had a meeting with Pakistani officials, and they've reduced the list, but said, we just want you to accept this and let's have a working relationship. And the BNP historically has always wanted a working relationship. So obviously it makes sense from Bangladesh's side, if you want to dilute your relationship with India, if you want to deal with India, it naturally makes sense. You try and have a working relationship with Pakistan, then obviously you've got China as well. And obviously here, you know, Pakistan has built military platforms. Pakistan is a trainer of other armies. It's obviously, you know, been to war multiple times. So in that sense, Pakistan would actually be quite useful from that perspective. Obviously, now it all depends upon, you know, building upon what they have. And actually, it seems, you know, with the BNP, Pakistan just has a better relationship because they've always wanted a working relationship with Pakistan. So a defence pact seems a sensible bit to start from. Because that's what Pakistan can offer. So in terms of, you know, the JF-17, which is a fighter jet they developed with China, that could potentially be on offer. Pakistan obviously has tanks, things like that. Obviously, I think militarily, you know, really, you've got a massive coast Bangladesh has. So, you know, naval support is what they really need. And that's where Pakistan potentially come in, especially China as well. But definitely the BNP wants a working relationship with Pakistan, historically has. So I think this is probably an area that will develop. And look, the BNP historically have been close to America. Pakistan's close to America. So from that side, it works as well. So yeah, all the roads are pointing towards a working relationship between Pakistan and Bangladesh going forward.
Ghazi, a lot of stuff that I've read and heard is, whoever comes into power, BNP, Jamaat-e-Islami, whoever, they need to be careful on how, you know, what type of relationship that they have with Pakistan. And again, you know, reiterating the 1971 war, it's because of that reason, because a lot of people within Bangladesh may not accept that. Is that still the case? Because now what we're seeing, you know, with the Gen Z, with the youth, is actually they want to grow closer with Pakistan to a certain extent. What I've read is that just more scaremongering?
Okay, this narrative actually is quite old. After the revolution, we saw the Gen Z and youth, among the youth and Gen Z especially, the 1971 is not a big thing here. So they're actually not bothered about this. And as Indian question is here, so youth actually wants quite a good relation with Pakistan. And when there are flurry of visits of Pakistan defense officials in Bangladesh, I saw the youths are very happy. They're in social media, they're very loud about this. So they're quite happy. They want a hedge against India. So they're that is why they're hedging against India with a building relationship with Pakistan and China. Even the youth-led party and the BNP, I saw their mandate and their election manifesto. They keep a point to build up a good relationship with Pakistan, and another point is to build our defense modernizations with surface-to-air missiles and new fighter jets. So they it's a new thing for them. So they're not actually, in previously we didn't saw these things. That's why we are building a strong defense or a strong reserve force. So this is actually coming from the youth pressure. So from the pressure from the Gen Z. So actually, youth are not bothered about the 1971. Oh, yes, there is some, still there is some old circle is there. They are still talking about the 1971. Yeah, Pakistan did this thing, West Pakistan did this thing, something like that. Even the political parties, especially BNP, they also talking about the 1971 because their leader, their founder, the General Zia, actually he's a war hero. So they have to keep saying that because their founder is from rising from this war. So this is the history of Bangladesh actually. So youths are not that bothered about the 1971 and the old narratives. So there is a new narratives here.
Just to add, yeah, you know, the general view in Pakistan is there is the view that because of India, Bangladesh separated. But actually, once the leaders who were in power in the 71 passed, the general view within the army and Pakistani public is we wronged them, we discriminated against them, and why would they not want to separate? And actually, even Musharraf wrote in his book, it was our fault Bangladesh separated. Because for the first 5 odd years, it was all India's fault. Because of India, it happened. And there was a reluctance to accept that you discriminated, you didn't give the sufficient financing, these sort of things. That's all completely changed. Now, army officers, when they write books now, they all write, yeah, we wronged them. We did wrong. We shouldn't have done what we did. And that's why they've actually separated. And that's actually quite a significant change because for many years, you couldn't say that. You had to blame it on India. And, you know, there's sufficient evidence and so much research into this that, you know, really, from the moment Jinnah said the official language of East and West Pakistan is Urdu, the problem started. You know, this was a language that actually wasn't even spoken in West Pakistan. It was a Northern Indian language spoken by the Mughals. So it wasn't even indigenous to West Pakistan. And how would it be indigenous to East Pakistan? And it just got bad to worse from there. And in the end, unfortunately, they sent the military in, they sent militias in to try and maintain power. But, you know, Musharraf even wrote in his book, you know, we were in the wrong. We neglected them, we discriminated against them. And that's why we are where we are.
Ghazi, there's a question for you. China has been a major investor in Bangladesh. Where do relationships stand currently, and what are we likely to see post-elections?
Okay, for the China, China is investing a lot from the even from the previous Awami League regime. They also work with them. And last time Xi Jinping visited Bangladesh during the Hasina regime, so he's offering $25 billion infrastructure development here. Because China has a question about G2 balance geostrategic location. It's close to China's new invaded Belt and Road, the sea energy routes. That is why it's very concerned about this location. And they want to keep investing here work with the government. But Hasina regime, it is right that they take the investment from China, but they didn't return it back with Chinese interest. So even you see that deep sea port, finally it went to Japan, not China. So China is very furious about this. As I remember, during the July uprising, when the revolution is is triggered or just boiling, Hasina visited the China, okay, but she cut short her visit one day and get back to Bangladesh because there is news that the Chinese reception was not good. So China also wants the Tista project to be completed by them. There is a because there is an Indian concern is there, so Hasina is not allowing China to do that. So for China, actually, the interim government after the revolution closely worked with them. Professor Dr. Yunus also visited China in the 50 years relationship with China and Bangladesh relationship. And even it's a new thing I saw, that China's Yunnan provinces governor visited Bangladesh and sit with the several parties, BNP, Jamaat Islam, even interim government. So Yunnan province is one of the geopolitical point from where China is connecting its new supply pipeline and energy route toward across the Myanmar. So supply route is entering Bengal and across the Myanmar to connecting the pipeline to the Yunnan. So it is quite astonishing that Yunnan province governor is visited Bangladesh and meet them. So it implies that what China wants actually here. So they will even BNP also keep close relationship with them. They in their 31 points outline, they also keep the line that the Tista project will be developed, and Chinese government also very interesting. And several times they talk to the BNP, even the interim government also talk to them, sit with them about the Tista project. But this is a strategic nightmare for India, because as you maybe heard that there is a chicken neck situated beside the Tista river. So China is actually looking for that, actually. So they can have a strategic pressure on India. So they also recently inaugurated a big hospital near Indian border in northern Bangladesh with a 1,000-bed facility. So it's also beside the Tista River. And China also, for the defense sector, China also all suppliers of Bangladesh defense equipments. So for the low-cost equipment, China can be a, in future a good option for Bangladesh also, beside Pakistan and Western weapons. So I think so. And as I said that earlier with the India question, the China will be youth's mind and Gen Z's mind, China will be presented as a hedge against India. So this is what Chinese question is here.
Adnan, anything you want to add?
Yeah, so, you know, as you can see from what Ghazi is saying, Bangladesh is actually really important for China for a number of reasons. China needs to find alternative routes for global trade. So going through Myanmar and coming to Bangladesh, the overland route, you've got that. You've got the Bay of Bengal, the strait, Malacca Straits opens up into the Bay of Bengal, which is critical for China. That's why you've seen China investing in Bangladesh in terms of ports, in terms of infrastructure. In many ways, China has put more money into Bangladesh than India has. India wants to have political alignment. China isn't necessarily after the political alignment. It's actually after, let's have a strategic relationship. We'll invest in ports and infrastructure. And in return, we want to make use of these as a win. So that's really an option for Bangladesh, really, to dilute the Indian relationship, to find an alternative to the Mazar. They're probably going to run into trouble with America over this. America won't be happy about this. However, unless America's going to put money into Bangladesh, I think they've got no choice, really. But it just means that China's got to be aware, if you're putting money into Bangladesh and the government has a relationship with America, in the long run, it potentially could be a problem. But in many ways, Bangladesh is more important for China than China is for Bangladesh. China is important for Bangladesh in terms of financing and infrastructure and development. But strategically, Bangladesh is like a strategic asset, really, for China. It needs it. It needs to have a good relationship with it. It deals with India, and it deals with its global strategy, really, which is alternative routes, really, beyond the seaways that we have, which are dominated by America. So it'd be interesting how the BNP navigate this now. I think it will continue. However, look, you can't have this open policy where you have a good relationship with India, America, and China. These are competitors amongst each other. They're not happy with each other. So now, Tariq Rahman spent the last 15 years in the UK. Now he's going to get tested. How do you plan to navigate all these relationships. I mean, if he navigates it well, he potentially could get a lot of money in. And, you know, Bangladesh is at the negotiation table, not as a listener, but as someone that's part of what's going on in the region. If he doesn't navigate it well, then, you know, you're going to see problems going forward. But, you know, in many ways, he's got a tricky thing to deal with now.
You mentioned US, and my next question is about US to yourself, Adnan. What the relationship like with between Bangladesh and America?
Yeah, so the BNP has always had a close relationship with America. Obviously, the Awami League had a security relationship with India. So in many ways, India was the priority in the relationship. But America really, you know, it goes back. America recognized Bangladesh very early when it came into being in 1971. America's had a relationship. At the time, it was part of America's Cold War strategy. You know, they wanted to create a number of nations around the Soviet Union. Obviously, once the Soviet Union went, America got busy with other things. And now you've got China. So from the emergence of China, Bangladesh actually becomes important. And again, that whole seaway, the Bay of Bengal, all of that is really, really important. So again, you know, it'd be interesting how the leader of Bangladesh navigates this, because you can't really be friends with everybody. It's physically not going to work. So, you know, the Awami League got into bed with India. That has its pros and cons, and, you know, they're overthrown, and so that shows you. On the other hand, look, you don't want to just get into bed with America or China on its own. Like, what are you getting in return? What are you, you know, this isn't they order you jump. It's got to be, okay, look, we're prepared to work with you, but this is what we expect in return. And we've not really seen that from Bangladeshi leaders historically. Either they've been with India or they've not been with India. And obviously, Bangladesh has always had significant domestic issues which have taken up the time of most governments. So probably an interesting time for the elections, really. There's quite a few decisions to be made, big decisions to be made.
No doubt. Final question for today's discussion. Ghazi, first to yourself, 18 months on, will these elections satisfy the demands of the people of Bangladesh?
Okay, the people's, they're demanding, where they already discussed what they're demanding. But this election, I doubt that they will actually fulfill those demands. Maybe BNP or Jamatla, especially the BNP, they already quite make themselves clear about some reform they will take, and they will complete it. And but the problem is, actually, you cannot sewing your torn out clothes with the thread of reform. Bangladesh needs a true structural change. There's given its geostrategic location and its competitive advantage as a fertile lands. So with a true structural changes, it can bring stability, the economic one, the social, the political, and it can be stand out as a potential power to counter in this South Asian region. So actually, as I said, that these reforms, if people wants to be independent and to be more, they want a more actually independent power. They want to see us the these things in South Asian region. So I think the those reform actually don't deliver those things in long term.
Adnan, same question to yourself.
Yeah, just to echo what Ghazi said, the reforms definitely don't go far enough. Really, you're tinkering, really. I think what will happen is you'll have a short honeymoon period. People just be happy you've had elections. The face has changed. So I think you're probably going to get 6 months, and then it's going to be okay. We want to see execution and delivery. And that's when we really get into business now. That's when, you know, what are you doing with the economy? What are you doing with foreign relations? What are you doing with industry? What's happening with development? And then I think the challenges will begin. Now, if the government goes down the iron fist route, then I think we'll get pretty quickly to people on the street and back to where we are. If they don't go down the iron fist route, then I think it will probably strengthen, it will long out a bit more in terms of it. It is very possible that the regime doesn't finish its term, so the government doesn't finish its term, and you have elections all over again. That is always an option. You have a vote of no confidence, or the government basically decides to step down, you have early election. That's always a possibility. I doubt they'll do that because you've spent, 15 years out of power. I think they will. But look, people came to the streets. They can do it again. So, let's wait and see. But, the odds are against them. There's some significant decisions that need to be made. And if they're not made or if there's delays, and there's already been delays, really what you're doing is you're just laying the groundwork for the people taking to the streets again.
I think it's a good idea to redo this podcast in 6 months' time with myself, yourself, Adnan and Ghazi. Be interesting to see what we discussed today, what's come out in 6 months. But I want to thank both of you guys for your time today. Ghazi, I know it's very late for you in Bangladesh, but thank you for your time. To our listeners, if you want to learn more about the issues raised today, please check out our website, www.geopolity.com. It's all one word. You can also learn more on other issues by accessing our website, where you will find comprehensive insights, analysis, articles, and deep dives. I'm Imran. Thank you for listening.